Welcome to X Maturity. This is a podcast where we have conversations about the joys and challenges of being a designer in tech. This is episode 59, and I'm your co-host, Susan.
And I'm your co-host, Sandrine.
If you like our podcast, please write and review us on your podcast platform. And you can also follow us and share the podcast to spread the word. You can follow us on Twitter. We are UX_maturity. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, where we are UX Maturity. And our website is uxmaturitypodcast.com. Okay, so last week, we took a break from our theme on insights, had a really, really nice guest, Leia, on the podcast, and I'm still buzzing from how energized I felt from that. But this week, we're coming back into our insights theme, digging deeper into how to get to insights in the first place and how to use insights. So how do we get to and from insights, basically? Just to recap how we defined insights in episode 57. We were thinking about insights as something we arrive at after interpreting and analyzing and making sense out of data and observations. Okay, so I suppose a good place to start is, Sandrine, why is it important that we go from data to insights? Why can't we just use data as it is?
Good question. I think you can use data just as it is, but then that means that you are only really focusing on one small element. And I think that would be quite dangerous, because for most projects, it will probably be quite risky, because that means you have only a very, very small part of the picture to make decisions. So I would not advise to just start on one piece of data for that reason. I think it's really important to transform data into insights, because it means that you need to gather more than one piece of data and really do that due diligence of going and trying to understand your problem space, the context, try to gather the data that you know, or seek new data as well if you need to do additional research, and then really extract the patterns from that data so that you have some key themes, some key patterns. And what is good is that those insights are much stronger because they are a combination of different data points. So that means that you're not just relying on one data point for that. So that makes the insight stronger, because there's different data that are kind of validating or at least showing that pattern. And the insights are also very essential for actually transmitting and communicating about key opportunities, key problems, key pain points or needs, and these are quite helpful for just communication purposes with the team, with the stakeholders, or to just bring up into other parts of the process as well. So I think that's why it's mostly important to transform, go from data to insights. Does that cover what you had in mind as well?
Yeah, big plus one. And to add to it, by transforming data into insights, you also make them more impactful to make decisions from. Because if you make decisions based on just pure data or pure observations, you don't necessarily make decisions based on meaning. The meaning comes from analyzing the data into meaningful insights. It sounds like a redundancy in speech, but insights tell you the why and what it means and what the human behavior and context around the data is. So like you rightly said, you can just use data, but if you use data without having analyzed what it means, then you risk making decisions without understanding what the data actually means at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the magic really happens when you start combining different data points and actually start to understand, oh, okay, so hold on, we have people who do this here, but they say that they're doing it for this reason, or they're also doing this. And then you get a completely different perspective on the problem. And that's where you actually start getting into the meat of it, actually, where you can get some really great opportunities that you probably would never have spotted if you were fixated on one metric or one data point. So yeah, absolutely.
That's a great point. And also, it's really valuable and impactful to combine different types of data, as in, for example, user researchers tend to use mixed methods when they do user research, and mixed methods as in quantitative and qualitative research techniques, gathering quantitative and qualitative research data, which can take various forms. Back in the day when I studied psychology, we would talk about the importance of triangulating data as well. So, which is in many ways similar to using different types of data. So a concrete example could be you gather data in the form of surveys, which can be qualitative, can also be quantitative, depending on what the questions are. But to get more meaningful insights out of them, to get a deeper understanding of what that survey data means, it's very helpful to also do user interviews, qualitative user interviews around similar topics, or even observations, contextual inquiries. And so you are triangulating the quantitative survey data with the qualitative observational data, and getting a much more fully fledged, rounded pool of insights from it.
Nice. I was wondering if you've tried a few techniques to go from data to insights, and I guess that's mostly happening in the define part of the double diamond, when you're really analyzing all of the data, all of the research findings that you got. Is there any technique in particular that you find is helpful for identifying patterns and getting to insights?
At the risk of being really boring and unoriginal, my go-to method is to do the old affinity mapping exercise. So affinity mapping is a bit of a fancy way of saying stick an observation from the data on a post-it note. These days it's probably usually in Miro or Figjam or something. Stick each interesting observation on a sticky note, have lots of sticky notes, and then group those sticky notes into meaningful groups and patterns, similar patterns. As you gather more and more data, you should hopefully have more and more sticky notes and more groups that you're increasingly confident are actual groups. In the beginning, you might need to regroup things. And what you end up with is a set of themes, essentially themes in your data, each group being a theme. And then you can hopefully draw some meaningful insights from them. This is very oversimplified. There's a lot of thinking and discussion and U-turns and what about this and what about that that happens in this process. But I would say the old affinity mapping technique doesn't really go out of style in my book. I will caveat, though, that I have a heavy bias towards qualitative data, not because I think qualitative data is better than quantitative data. It's just what I'm better at doing and where I feel most comfortable, where I feel the most comfortable working in, and also what I enjoy the most. So maybe one of these days we should have a very quant focused person on the podcast to ask more quant specific questions and get their thoughts. But yeah, grouping things into patterns, tagging insights. It's I feel like this affinity mapping technique is the UX version of something I learned in psychology, which is called grounded theory. This is getting very academic, but in qualitative research, which is often used in fields like psychology and sociology and a lot of social sciences, when you deal with a lot of qualitative data, is you can apply a technique called grounded theory, where you identify patterns and meaning and themes and tags in your qualitative data bottom up, rather than apply a top down lens on the data. So a top-down lens would be using an existing theoretical framework, for example, and then seeing if the data fits into that theoretical framework. Very long-winded answer, but basically finding meanings by tagging and grouping observations in your qualitative data, I think, is very powerful. And then the second technique, it's not a second technique, but the second thing I think helps is that you establish up front what your research questions are, and then you look for answers to your research questions in your data as well.
Yeah, I like what you said, because I'm also very much likely to do affinity mapping when I get to analysis parts. I do think it's a powerful technique. I personally quite like to tag my insights a bit differently depending on tag my data differently depending on what they are. So I like to tag, I guess I would use different post-it color and have a bit of a key, basically. And I like to identify the quotes, so what people say. I like to have what people do. So, you know, if there's an action, especially if we've done a bit of usability testing, or if we have some quantitative data of what people do, because the quants can tell you very well what people do. I will also bring that back as, you know, current behavior, or things that people do. And then people, like, more generally, what people say, they're just general opinions as well. And I find it interesting sometimes that you can see a bit of a conflict between what people do and what they say. And more often, actually, it's quite interesting to reflect on why there's a gap. And sometimes it's because they say they're going to do something, actually, it's not really what they intend to do. And sometimes you actually see that that's not what they do. So if you try to change your behavior in your problem space, it's quite interesting, because if you just go and obviously take the piece of data on what they say as, you know, as granted, you might actually go into the wrong path as well. So it's quite interesting to, I guess, polarize and kind of look at them both with an objective lens and see if you should follow what they say, observe what they do, and kind of try to figure out, okay, there's a mismatch, why? And that might actually, you might have to seek more data to actually understand that why as well. That's what I find interesting, is when you do affinity mapping, sometimes you have more questions that come up, because you're starting putting things together and you're like, hold on, like, these things, like, they make a pattern, but we don't really understand why that pattern comes up. And that might lead you to go back in the process and go and ask more questions. So I found that quite helpful. Also really like what you said about reflecting back to your research questions. I think sometimes that's something that I can easily lose track of. So I try these days to bring back my assumptions or my hypothesis that we went with for the research, and literally just say, are these questions validated, invalidated, or, you know, we're still not really sure? And then we can explain basically, yeah, exactly what is related to those questions. And I find it quite clear, and it helps to have a bit of continuity in your, you know, it helps kind of clarify a bit of ambiguity sometimes in the project when you have a lot of data and people are a bit, oh my God, like too many data points, too many insights. And it helps to kind of bring it back to, so we seek to answer these questions and here's the answer. And it kind of creates a nice continuity, basically. So people who want to catch up on the project don't have to look at your wall of data. They can just go straight to, have we answered these questions or not?
I used to work at a place where I feel like one of the most frequently asked questions whenever people were giving feedback on things or challenging people in whatever context there was the question, what are we trying to learn, or what are you trying to learn with this? And being in that setting, really, I carry that question with me in pretty much anything I do these days. What am I trying to learn with this? Why am I doing this discovery piece? What am I trying to learn? Or why am I doing this experiment? What am I trying to learn? And that sort of, that goes into the research questions you set in the beginning, and it should follow you as a thread as you're going through your data and transforming them into insights. It's a sort of, so what does this data mean? What am I learning here? What are the insights I'm learning? That hopefully answers my research questions.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really key point when you're trying to get from data to insights, is you should always have that thread, as you said, because otherwise you can really start getting way too broad and start opening some doors that you probably should keep closed for that specific project, unless you have a very, very broad scope and a very wide discovery. Often you kind of would have a kind of a remit or like a sort of like large scope where you know you're looking into a problem space, and obviously your research may touch on related problem spaces or things that affect it, but are kind of just too much outside of where you can really take action right now. So I think, as you said, going back to those research questions, making sure you stay on track is really important, because otherwise you're going to start analyzing patterns and insights for a completely different project opportunity. And whilst this could be helpful in the future, obviously that might not help you to solve what you intended to solve in the beginning. So
yeah, I very much agree. I'm one of these people who I studied psychology because I'm interested in people. So if I don't have guardrails in the form of research questions, I will find everything interesting, like even the most, you know, what to other people seems like extremely boring detail, I'll find everything fascinating. So yeah, having focus in the form of research questions really help. I liked what you said earlier about how there's often a difference between what people say and what you observe, them actually doing, which makes me think about different types of data we can have. So a lot of the times when we do interviews, a lot of the data is verbatim quotes and what they say. When we do usability tests, we often not just, you know, listen to what they say, but also look at their facial expressions, body language. Are they saying that, oh, this makes sense, but then they look totally confused? You know, there's that discrepancy. It makes me think about how insights can take different shapes. So for example, if you gather lots of quotes or even survey responses, the insights could be more around people's attitudes, so like what they think or their perceptions. Whereas if your insights are based more on observational data, then they can take the shape of more like, for example, people struggle at this stage because of these reasons. Hopefully you know the reasons because you were able to ask them or to have them verbalize their thoughts. I wonder, Sandrine, what different shapes your insights take when you say, you know, this is an insight. Like, are they statements? Are they pictures of a cluster of post-it notes? Are they a report? Like, what does an insight actually look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for me, usually there will be, a short statement is often what I would go for. I would try to take it from the user perspective of like, you know, X cannot, you know, do this, or X, like, I don't know, we observe that users, you know, like I would kind of, make a broad statement in that way. I've had some really interesting projects where we were trying to understand people's mental model of something quite complex. It was like, I was working in the credit industry and there was a lot of like financial concepts that we wanted to explore and how people were picturing them in their minds. How do they understand them? And it was kind of complex. And we just didn't really know how people understood all of these different terms, etc. So we obviously went on and asked a bunch of questions during our interviews. And what I ended up doing was visualizing the mental model. So I'll take a ridiculous example, but for example, we asked people to just explain, I guess, how they think of different concepts in relation to each other. So we had some people, for example, that were telling us that the bedroom is in the house. So we would obviously have a bubble that represents the house with the bedroom inside. So another smaller bubble inside the house bubble for the bedroom. But interestingly, we had some other people when they were explaining it, they were actually having the house inside the bedroom, for example. So, you know, and we could see where, so obviously this is a very silly example, but it it helped us see how people were completely either misunderstanding what the concept actually really was, or sometimes just that they had a different perception of it. So that means that the way they were expecting to relate to the concept or relate to that notion, that financial notion, was quite different, and they will understand it differently. So we had to kind of either realign them or educate, or just kind of go on with their perception of it. So yeah, that was quite interesting, and visualizing it. So we kind of visualized for each participant their mental model. And we've realized actually that we had two mental models that came up. So we had kind of a pattern that we had X amount of users that had this mental model that was very similar, and then other users had these, like, another type of mental model. And we could see they were very different. And that kind of helped us to visualize that. And then that was so easy for us as well to just simplify all of these complex, like, terms and concepts to just two bubble diagrams, basically. And it was very clear to see where the confusion of the users were, or what their mental model was, and why it was different from what we were trying to tell them. So yeah, it was just really, really interesting way of extracting the insights, kind of analyzing it, and then just communicating about it. Then we were able to just rely on that visualization. So that was quite nice. I don't think I've been able to do something like that since, but that was one of the, yeah, most interesting way. Otherwise, I tried to visualize insights as much as possible. So if you can have some sort of like visualization of them, is always quite helpful. There's some insights that play very nicely for this. Obviously, some others, a statement is just the best way to be clear about them, but any way to visualize. For me, I'm quite a visual person when it comes to analyzing, reflecting on things. And I think a lot of people are. So if you have a way of making it visually more digestible, it's always good, especially for communicating with the team and stakeholders.
I love that example with the mental model, because it makes me reflect on a lot of the visual diagrams I've made to make sense and communicate insights as well. I've only done mental modeling a couple of times, and I really enjoyed it. I find it a very powerful technique. Another thing that comes to mind is I used to work for a marketplace where one set of users needed to search for and choose from another set of users. So the demand side had to search for and choose from the supply side. And I was doing quite a lot of research into what are the criteria for choosing, like how are the demand side users choosing which supply candidate to go for. This is very vague. I hope it makes sense. And so I ended up gathering lots of data on criteria. And they ranged from deal breaker criteria to kind of very nice to have criteria, and then should have criteria. So it was kind of like, you know, it's sort of like when you choose an Airbnb, I guess, which is a similar thing. It's a marketplace. And your deal breaker criteria could be it must be in this location. And the should very nice to have criteria is it should be under this budget. And then the sort of nice to have criteria is like a pool or whatever, you know, so it kind of ranges from that. I did the same in this other marketplace context. And on one level, my insights from that piece of research did come in the form of kind of simple statements, like the demand side chooses based on these criteria because this is important. But what also helped was to draw a pyramid now I can't remember if I had the pointy part of the pyramid up or down. Anyway, a pyramid of almost like a, you know, like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it was, you know, a hierarchy of criteria in the context of these people choosing in the marketplace which supply they wanted. It didn't take that much time. A pyramid isn't the most complex of visualizations, but it really helped me solidify the insights I gathered as to, you know, the criteria for choosing. And it also really was a powerful way of communicating the insights, a lot of insights to a wider audience without requiring them to read lots of text. It was very easy to see, okay, these are the must-haves. We really need to nail these criteria in their search. These are the nice-to-haves, and these are the sort of should-haves, but not essential. So yeah, just a plus one to the power of visualizing and modeling your insights in some sort of framework as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I tend to stay away from reports. I think reports are amazing for very formal communication, where you're going to have a presentation back to the company, or if you want to just document. I think reports are great for that, and they have a great reason to exist for this. But when you want to use insights on the go with your team, or you want to keep stakeholders in the loop, I think, yeah, having a nicer way to digest is definitely better. It makes me think that I forgot to talk about the empathy mapping technique as well, which is a bit different from the affinity mapping. And what I like about empathy mapping is that it makes you reflect around the user, or just the human being's environment, and how that data fits, how the data that you found out fits into it. And I find it quite interesting how there is some elements about, you know, what people hear, for example, what are they likely to hear in their environment, you know, in like what they're likely to see. And I think this is quite interesting as well, to find some data sometimes that are related to these, I guess, to these senses, because they're a big part of your experience as a human being, and it's likely to get in the way of them experiencing your product. And, you know, sometimes they might hear things that are actually going to go against having the behavior that you intend to create for them as well. So it's always quite helpful to see if there's anything in their direct environment as well that is likely to disrupt the experience. And it's always good to reflect as well. So I find empathy mapping quite powerful to kind of, yeah, set the data against, I guess, a different type of data set to kind of understand, okay, so this is actually the context that they evolve in. They say that they want to do this, but their environment doesn't support them to do this, for example, because I don't know. For example, if you help people meditate, but they're in an environment that is very noisy, maybe, you know, they're not in the right place, for example. So it's kind of interesting sometimes to see how you might not be able to generate your behavior because, yeah, other factors play in. So I found that method quite useful.
Yeah, absolutely. These design frameworks or UX frameworks are incredibly helpful in helping you structure your thinking. I haven't used the empathy mapping that much, not lately, but you remind me of the experience mapping framework, which I at least used to use a lot. It used to be my go-to. Now it depends a bit because I'm getting a bit, I find that I don't tend to work on linear chronological journeys anymore. But yeah, all this to say, like there are lots of really good and powerful frameworks out there of modeling behavior and attitudes and experiences that you can draw from.
Yeah, you know what? With experience mapping, they're always frustrating the hell out of me. I try to make them, but then I don't find them representative. And that's why I go back then more to empathy mapping or affinity mapping, because the insights are a bit loose. There's no, yeah, you don't have to worry about the linear journey. I find that when I try to do an experience mapping, I have so many branching happening because it's like, you just can actually do this and this and this. And it's like, yeah, I just get frustrated with it. It's very interesting to align, I guess, frustrations of the user, pain points and needs. And I think for some projects, it's very relevant to have them. But yeah, I tend to just be a bit fidgety when I try to use the method.
I see what you mean. I think it's also why I said, like, I used to use them, but I don't that much anymore. I think I look at problems in a more a focused way, I think, or problem space sometimes, not always. Sometimes I go like big and generative and stuff. But if I'm focusing on a specific problem space, then behavior in that problem space isn't necessarily linear or chronological. And so, yeah, it doesn't always make sense to shoehorn your data and your insights into prescribed templates. So I'd also advise people to be a bit careful. Like, templates can be so helpful, but you're allowed to break out of your templates, which reminds me of this other template framework, I guess, that I use more recently to help me communicate insights, which is something I learned from this amazing head of user research that I used to work with, and I learned so much from her. And she would call it drivers and barriers. And I think I combined the drivers and barriers framework with a jobs to be done framework, and used it to map. So if I was faced with a problem space, I would use it to map the forces driving people towards the product you're working on, and also map the forces that go against the people, or go against your product. So the barriers people have towards your product. This is a very simplified way of explaining it, but the format you take when you decide to represent your insights and map them out and model them, it really depends on what it is you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're working in some form of acquisition or growth type of work, like switches forces, which are, I think, under the jobs to be done methodology.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. So get the jobs to be done book, or Intercom also has tons of articles on this. They're great. They're such a great way of visualizing these things. And it's like, I feel like when you present insights in this way, it actually kind of has a chance to tick with stakeholders, because they're like, huh, we're trying to acquire users, but we actually have four forces against us, whilst we have only one positive force to get people in. And that's when it makes people maybe realize that actually there's way too many barriers for the user. And yeah, I think this is always great to just visualize. It's so much more helpful, because it helps people get a picture in their heads. Sometimes people just get a bit annoyed with statements and words and numbers. They see so many every day, and it's like, they're just, people want to get to an outcome, to an impact, and maybe seeing things sometimes as an image or a visualization can help them, I don't know, can help them see a bit more how that helps them get to that goal.
Yeah, that's a great point about it being better for stakeholders to be involved as well. I find that by including stakeholders almost in the insights generation process, or workshopping through the insights, using visual frameworks to work on things together, is incredibly, incredibly helpful. And as we've spoken about before, stakeholders have so much insights themselves, and so they're not, it's not just us handholding them through the process. They are adding to the insights sense making process as well.
There's another shape as well that I like to use for my insights. I like to shape them sometimes into job stories. And that's sometimes when I make statements, I will use the job story framework. And I find that also quite powerful. It's a bit different from the how might we. I find that the how might we is really great for ideation when you're in brainstorming and you need a very clear statement to ideate on. But the job stories for me is super, super helpful to carry on that into my design phase. Like, when I get into solution development, I can literally just explore solutions in relation to that job story. And that job story gives me all the insights, because it's, the job story is structured as when something happens for my user, or when my user in a specific environment doing something specific or trying to do something specific. Then there's like I think it's, they want to see, like, they want to see an out, like a measure of progress so that they can reach an outcome. So it's like, when, I want to, so that, So there's like, what I like is, contrary to user stories, is that they're not focused on solution. They're focused on a context, which are the condensed version of all of your data points into an insight. And then there's like that measure of progress of like potentially a way that, you know, could help, it's something that users or people have expressed could be an improvement over what they're currently experiencing, and then the outcome, so ultimately what they're really trying to achieve. And that's just a really powerful way, I find, to frame just your design exploration whilst carry on the insights into that space as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me think about the importance of insights being actionable. And the way you describe with job stories, for example, is a very powerful way of doing that, because it has an outcome in the format. It has context and it has outcome. So I wanted to dig a bit deeper into that. How do we make sure we can use the insights? Like, how do we go from having, you know, insight statements or these visualizations, however form our insights take, how do we go from there to decisions, for example, or solutions, or what do we do from there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for me, it's really key to transform those insights into, as you say, actionable. So job stories are actionable, how might we statements are actionable, problem statements are actionable, or like opportunity statements. And I think that's quite helpful. You know, you can basically go back to your opportunity tree that we keep talking about, but you could basically add the statements in your opportunity tree after the data so that they condense the insights from the data points that you got. And then you have them as clear opportunities. And normally your opportunity is meant to, yeah, give you an angle as to how to tackle that, you know, starting challenge that you started your project with. It's about having an angle as to how to solve that problem. So that angle gives you some insights as to why the problem exists and potentially some first kind of potential starting points as to how to start solving it. So I find helpful to use a framework, and some teams prefer a framework over another. Sometimes designers as well like a specific way of shaping the insights as well. So I think it really depends on the person and on the team. So I don't think one answer is the right. There's no like one answer for everyone. So it's more about the team and the type of project. And yeah, just, I would say just play with it and see which one makes it easiest for you to make sure that your solutions actually reflect and solve the problem. I think sometimes I see that the insight wasn't actionable when I'm in solution mode. I'm just not even thinking about the user anymore, and I'm just designing something based on, we say we design feature X, and like I'm thinking about designing feature X as opposed to solving X problem for users. So that's when I'm going back to my statements and making sure that I understand what I'm actually doing this for.
Yeah, and it's a lot about it's a lot about piecing together all the things we keep talking about. So piecing together your actionable insight statements to your opportunity solution tree, if you have it, to your OKRs, if you have them. Like you said, it depends on the different teams work differently, but hopefully you have some sort of mapping of opportunities, whatever shape that takes. Hopefully you have some sort of goals and objectives and focus. It doesn't have to be OKRs, but it's popular, so we tend to refer to that a lot, but some sort of focus. And the insights support that focus and help drive your direction. It also depends on practical things like how much time do we have and how many people are we and stuff like that. So taking all of that together, insights play a huge role into making decisions and having outcomes and impact at the end of this sausage machine. It's not a sausage machine. I don't know why I said that. I'm going to go with it. Sausage machine of product and design thinking. Cool. And with that, I think we've talked around the topic of how to get to insights and how to get from insights. What are you grateful for this week?
I don't know if it's something that I'm grateful for, but something that I guess once that thing is there, I would definitely be grateful to have it. So earlier we were texting before starting the episode, and I said, bring your waffles in, because sometimes Susan and I waffle quite a bit when we're doing the podcast, which we edit all, obviously. And it made me think about waffles. And It made me realize that I'm craving waffles right now. So I am just ordering a waffle maker, and I will be making waffles. So yeah, I would be very grateful when that waffle maker comes in, and yeah, it'd be great.
Amazing. I have a waffle maker as well. It's a Scandinavian waffle maker, so the waffles are thinner, and they're so useful. I recommend everyone to have one.
I've never heard of a Scandinavian waffle maker. What's the difference?
They're the thinner ones. They're much thinner than, for example, Belgian or the Americans.
Right. Yeah, I like the Belgian one. That's like...
Oh, hungry now. I'm grateful for all the amazing product managers I've worked with, and I am particularly this week because I was editing our guest episode with Leah that we mentioned that we had last week, and it just made me really think about all the wonderful product managers I've worked with, all the wonderful empowered product teams I've been in, and all the wonderful duos I've had with great product managers. And I was just like, oh my god, I am so lucky to have worked with so many people. It was a really nice reflection and feeling to have, and I've learned so much from all of them. I should reach out to them and say thank you. That's something people in general should do, I think.
I am like a big plus one on this. I've been also thinking about it this week. Absolutely. Yeah, very grateful as well that I can count quite a few people that I would definitely work with again or continue working with. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And with that, we are rounding off the episode. Thanks so much again for listening every week to our waffles. This was episode 59. We're going to continue next week with another episode on insights. As mentioned, you can follow us on Twitter at UX_maturity, on LinkedIn as UX Maturity, and our website is uxmaturitypodcast.com. Thank you so much.